focus on the book is on morally proper behavior. And you focused on torture, but also on invasion of privacy and illegal behavior by presidents. Connecting all three to the Bush administration, although not it alone. Some might think that the gravest devastation of the last 8 years, however, was wrought not by illegal or unethical behavior, but by the Iraq War, its planning and execution being merely a very serious mistake in judgment. Is bad statesmanship in security matters arguably much worse than illegality and immorality?
It's very different. Bad statesmanship is hard to avoid frequently encountered. Grossly immoral behavior is something which we can avoid, and we know what it is that we should avoid, and we can be told what it is we should avoid. On the other hand, to wag a finger at a president and say, be prudent, be wise, is a injunction without too much content, although we would wish that it would be followed.
I agree. I think it's a different issue. What we're talking about are matters of principle, not matters of specific acts of prudence. And undermining matters of principle has, in my view, when, if they're genuinely core principles, has a longer lasting deleterious effect on the character of a nation than a single miscalculation in diplomatic or military affairs, although those can be devastating as well, of course.
Why don't you each take a couple of minutes and see if some of the audience has probably read the book, some not. Take a few minutes and see if you can give the folks a summary of the
Well, we'll do book. That. I'll talk about one set of things, and then Gregory will talk about the other. More or less in the order in which at least the first drafts appeared from our pens, although by the time the thing reached print, we had been so smooshed together that it's really hard to say who put those particular chocolate chips into the cookie. The tag, which we start with and which gives the book its at least headline banner title, is this, that there's a difference between things which are illegal because they are wrong, and things which are wrong because they are illegal. And torture, on one hand, is the prime example, and it's the one we develop at some length, of something that is illegal because it is wrong. violations of laws such as FISA and so on that the Bush administration engaged in right after 9/11 with unwarranted wiretaps and surveillance of cyberspace and so on were illegal if they were because were wrong if they were because they were illegal. And that's a difference. The wiretaps and so on were wrong because they were illegal. The torture was illegal because it is wrong. Now, there's considerable reluctance on the part of a lot of people who would never dream of torturing themselves, of course, let's say torturing others, or authorizing torture, to admit that torture is an absolute prohibition. Absolute prohibitions make people nervous. They even make people nervous who, in fact, in their own lives and choices, would adhere to such prohibitions. And this is shown by the fact that all the people who have this decent and correct instinct cast about for arguments of an empirical sort that, well, it never works, or it is wrong more, or it provides wrong answers more often than it provides right answers, and the results are unreliable. Or you can always get this information in some other way. And those arguments make me nervous. They make me nervous because, as an empirical fact, they may be, as an empirical matter, they may be correct a lot of the time. They surely aren't correct all the time. And when they are not correct, then the temptation to torture would come in. And it's so interesting that people resist the absolute prohibition. It's a prohibition which, by the way, is very old. In the United States law, President Lincoln, in the Lieber Code, promulgated in 1863, which, by the way, is the first code for the conduct of war in any nation, talks about many things, talks about how it's perfectly proper to kill combatants, how it's perfectly admissible or regrettable that non-combatants be killed as a result of what today is called collateral damage. But there's one thing that is stated with great clarity: torture and cruelty are absolutely forbidden. That great torturer, the Catholic Church, in recent years has emitted an exactly similar absolute pronouncement in 1993, Pope John Paul II, in the encyclical Veritatis Splendor. Well, how do you make a case that something is absolutely wrong? We try two different ways. First of all, graphically, we show a painting, a very stark and striking painting, of somebody being tortured by the painter Leon Golub. And then we discuss what happens in torture. But in the end, we understand that this is not a unanswerable argument. It is not, as my dear friend who I so regret, who I so miss, Bob Nozick, said in one of his books, a good argument is not like a machine gun. It does not physically disable you from objecting. So we don't try to machine gun you into agreement. What we do show, and I think what can be shown, is that the absolute prohibition is reasonable. It is not unreasonable. It is in line with many other things that we believe and which guide us. We do not think that everything has a price. The important thing is that the prohibition on torture is not a goal. We don't go out in the world and try to have as little torture as there might be, because if that were it, you'd say, well, let's have a little torture today so that we have, which is Lenin's type of argument, so that we have much less torture in the future. No. The prohibition is a constraint. And the picture is that we can pursue many goals, and we can argue about many goals. And in the pursuit of goals, there are trade-offs, as the utilitarians like to say, and that's fine. The constraints are the borders, the limits within which those goals are pursued. And once again, to quote my hero, Lincoln said, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master. As I would not be a tortured, so I would not be a torturer. It is connected with the kind of persons we want to be. And survival is, after all, not physical survival. We will all not survive, every one of us. But what we survive as. And what we want to survive is as certain kinds of human beings, and respecting the absolute constraint, the absolute prohibition against torture, describes the kind of human being we want to survive as, the kind of human being that it is worth trying to survive as.
So I want to carry this argument forward. My father mentioned the tag that torture is or should be illegal because it is wrong, whereas violations of privacy, forms of surveillance, eavesdropping, and the like, are wrong because they are illegal. And that might make it sound like we're making a purely relativistic argument on invasions of privacy, and I don't think that's quite right. And so I want to put a little bit more meat on those bones. We do believe that there is a core value of privacy, that in any decent society that respects fundamental principles will give its people some refuge of privacy to which they may retreat, and that that is a necessity of the human condition. However, what the contours of that region of privacy are must depend somewhat on the traditions of the society that we're speaking of and the technological progress in that society. A society without telephones or recording machines or the internet is a very different kind of society than one that has those things. And for a state to embark upon its investigative and prosecutorial powers, there must be some capacity for the duly appointed officers of that state to invade the zone of privacy. We believe, therefore, that while privacy is an important value, it is not an absolute one, and in that sense is different from the question of torture. And that brings me to the third main subject of our book, which is executive authority. And as we were working on these other two topics, we recognized that the world after 9/11, which has pushed us into these divisive questions of surveillance and of torture, has also brought with it a crisis in terms of how the American people relate to the conception of executive power. And that has been embodied by some of the arguments that the Bush administration has made, particularly around its use of torture. I can say more about that. But here the decisive question is, to what extent is any duly appointed officer of the law responsible to uphold the rule of law, come what may? In other words, is the rule of law an absolute in the same way that the prohibition on torture is an absolute? And surprisingly, what we want to argue in the book is that no, officers of the law are sometimes required to break the law. Not all laws, but some laws. And so, to mention some examples, one example we use in the book is an everyday example of a woman reported in the Boston Globe in early winter of 2008. Her name was Jennifer Davis. She was pregnant, and she went into labor. And the hospital that her husband was to bring her to was on the route, they had to go down Route 2. Well, she had the misfortune of going into labor at rush hour. And she had to get to the hospital along Route 2, and there was a traffic jam. And her husband drove in the breakdown lane. And that is against the law in the state of Massachusetts. And they ran into one state trooper who saw what was going on, and he waved them through. They ran into another state trooper, paused, saw that this was a pregnant woman in labor, waved them through. They ran into a third state trooper, stopped them, saw what was going on, and then wrote them up a ticket while she was in labor. And the state police of Massachusetts said he made a principled decision based on his understanding of the rule of law. They were breaking a law. He had to write them a ticket. Now, philosophy, going back as far as Aristotle, has said, well, Aristotle says, that there is a principle of equity or reasonableness in the law. And that is because there is no such thing as a law which can anticipate all the possible conditions in which it would be applied. And that any reasonable lawgiver, in the context of Jennifer Davis getting to the hospital, would say, of course, Jennifer should be waved through and we should ignore this law on the breakdown lane. The problem is, you can never write all the conceivable exceptions into the law. And therefore, people who have a responsibility to the law need to be able to make the judgment about when it should be ignored. But that is a terribly dangerous principle, too, in a liberal democracy dedicated to the rule of law, for obvious reasons. So how do we get out of this bind? And here we have we make use of the examples of Presidents Jefferson and Lincoln. Jefferson, in 1807, was faced with a situation following the Chesapeake Affair, where a British warship fired on an American warship, with the very real possibility that the United States would go to war with Great Britain, in a very unprepared state. And so he took it upon himself to requisition the funds to re-equip our fortresses and navies to prepare for this contingency, which was clearly a violation of the Constitution, because only Congress has the authority to requisition those funds. What he did is he then went to Congress and said, I've done this. It's clearly a violation of the law. What I'm asking you to do is ratify what I have done. Abraham Lincoln did the same thing with habeas corpus at the outset of the Civil War. It is only the Congress that can suspend habeas corpus. But Lincoln did. And he recognized that that was a violation, and then he went to Congress and said so, and they then ratified what he had done. And in the same way, a police officer who not only waves you through but escorts you to the hospital should tell his or her boss the next day, boss, chief, this is what I've done. Here are my badge and my gun. If you think it's really serious, you know, accept my resignation. And presumably, the chief will say, you know, forget about it. Take your badge, take your gun, and get back to work. So the way to repair the breach in the rule of law is for those who are responsible to recognize it and to seek reconciliation through the avenues that are available to them. So where does this leave us?
Well, where that leaves us is with a couple of dilemmas. What of the situation where the president goes to the Congress and says, here's what I've done, please ratify this? And that in the Bush administration, that happened. The Congress ratified Bush's violations of FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. They ratified them. It certainly didn't happen with torture. Indeed, Congress, at the instance of Senator McCain, reconfirmed the prohibition. But what happens when the president goes and says, I've done this, now please ratify it, make it good, as we lawyers say, nunc pro tunc, and the rule of law is healed, and Congress doesn't do anything. They do nothing. Greg, for that situation, had the wonderful idea, which I keep saying is genuinely patentable, that what ought to happen is the president should say, look, we've got to fix this somehow, and you won't do anything. I have drawn up my own articles of impeachment. Here they are, presents them to the House Judiciary Committee, proceed. And if then they really sit on it, then I think he ought to relax. Now, of course, Bush, in respect to torture, has done none of those things. None of those things. Did in respect to FISA, kicking and screaming, but did. And the question is, what ought to happen? How is the breach to be healed then? Gregory has one view.
Well, what I've argued, and I think it's important to underline that these are extremely difficult questions, but what I argue in the book is that not only are the acts, in other words, the torture, such a serious crime, but also the theory of presidential power advanced by the Bush administration so contrary to fundamental American principles, namely that in his role as commander-in-chief, the president is unable to break a law, not because he can't, but because no law can stand before a president seeking to secure the national security. That was the doctrine that was advanced. That is such a serious refutation, in my view, of the balance of powers, that both it and the engagement in torture have to be repudiated. And the way that we do that in our system with crimes and with faulty legal philosophies is through prosecution. If there were another way, I'd be glad to hear it. But I don't know of it yet.
Well, it's a dilemma. And as eloquently as Gregory has made the case for the prosecution, I am quite convinced that there will be no prosecutions, and indeed that there should not. It may be because I've lived through Watergate, followed by Billygate, followed by Iran-Contra, followed by the farce of Whitewater and Monica Lewinsky, and it makes it quite clear, and history makes quite clear, that in a functioning democracy, which we surely have, there is a very good reason why those who have ousted the persons before them should not try to put them in jail. We have never done that, and we shouldn't start now, because if you start down that path, then those in power may be tempted never to give it up because of the risks that will befall them if they do, or they will await the chance to take their turn to prosecute the next group. And it's a terrible Oresteian kind of cycle. And we have to remember that Vice President Cheney and Attorney General Gonzalez and Don Rumsfeld, though they authorized terrible things on an inadmissible theory, they were not, people keep talking about Nuremberg, they were not Hitler, they were not Pol Pot. They were trying to protect us against an enemy who certainly had no hesitation at all to torture and kill as many innocent people as they possibly could. They made the wrong judgments. They made bad judgments. Those judgments must be repudiated. But if we went for criminal prosecutions, one practical result would be that those prosecutions would not even begin until well into the second Palin administration. And they might very well...
You laugh.
You laugh, yes. And they might very well result in acquittals. And then where would we be? So I think we have to find some other way. I haven't thought what it would be. I had one rather cunning idea, which was, well, maybe what President Obama should do. President Obama seems to share my distaste for the criminal prosecutions and has said so all along. What he ought to do is he ought to issue a pardon to Rumsfeld, Cheney, and so on and so forth, stating that they have committed these and these crimes, but they are being pardoned. There is a precedent for it. It is what Gerry Ford did for Richard Nixon, and it was an act of great wisdom and great courage. I hadn't read it at the time we wrote. I should have included it in the book for my little peroration at my part, where our voices diverge, which is only the last 5 or 6 pages, because Gerald Ford's proclamation there is, I think, the best case that could be made against the prosecutions.
So the central message of the book is that torture is absolutely wrong. You're making the absolutist argument. You begin with this dramatic reproduction of the painting of a fascist officer's truncheoning a victim who is hung upside down naked in a cell. But then you say that it is not an aesthetic or emotional argument that's the basis for your contention. You invoke the image of God, you quote from the scriptures, but you then say this is not premised on a religious foundation. And you reject rather flatly the suggestion that it's necessary to establish pragmatically that torture mm-hmm. is always wrong. You think it's wrong even if it's pragmatically useful. What do you say to someone who says this is a personal intuition of yours, but I don't happen to share your intuition? What's the persuasive power or the premise from which you proceed?
That is the burden of the chapter discussing torture. And it is, first of all, directed at changing your intuition. And it does that first evocatively, in the ways you mentioned, but then also the rational argument is that should we succeed in persuading you of this, do not believe that you've been persuaded to an unreasonable or an unusual position. Because in fact, to accept moral constraints on your choices and behavior is not unreasonable and is not unusual. To be sure, some people don't, but many people do, and most of us do, in fact. And this then can be easily put among the lists of things that you would not do.
And I would also say, to repeat my father's citing of Bob Nozick's wonderful line that an argument is not a machine gun, that there is a point at which one can't force people to share one's intuitions. But what I might say is that the United States has had a long tradition of eschewing torture from the Bill of Rights and its prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment, to George Washington's proclamation after the Battle of Trenton or Princeton that the Hessians, who had treated American soldiers with great cruelty, should not be treated with similar cruelty. Of course, there have been departures from that in American history, but what is it, I would say, about not only my father in his initial remarks pointed to the question of what kind of people do we want to survive as? And the way he framed it was in terms of ourselves as individuals. As I do not want to be tortured, I would not want to be a torturer. What I would do to a person like the one you cite is to say, what are the habits of thought and conduct that are necessary to a democratic republic? What kind of instincts and intuitions are necessary to the people of a democratic republic? Repugnance against torture, I would argue, must be one of our instincts. And this is what I've called a sort of quasi-Burkean argument in favor of the prohibition against torture. Torture is the practice of tyrannies. And if we get into the habit of one of the most singular habits of tyranny, we should not imagine that the utilitarian calculus of the rationalists will preserve us from it infecting all other branches of our civic life. Torture is a powerful venom, and once it enters the system, it eats away at the fundamental habits and traits of a democratic people.
So, and this will be my last inquiry. We'll try to provoke some questions from our audience. But could not a president faced with the familiar ticking nuclear bomb scenario and a villain who says, I planted the bomb, it's going to go off in some large city and I know where it is and you can't make me tell you, couldn't a president who failed to waterboard or let loose the people with the pliers going after the thumbnails, watching the city explode, and think he had acted immorally or she had acted immorally?
Indeed. And I hope my father will answer this question. That is
thanks.
But I will say, yes, I mean, the problem with ethics is sometimes it puts you in a position where you don't want to be. And that is, I think, what ethics asks us to live with. I think that what would one do in a situation like that? One doesn't want to ask oneself those questions. And what it reminds me of is some of the castaway lifeboat cases of the 19th century where people ate each other. Well, I guess they didn't eat each other. They would eat one or more of the people there. And nobody thought that was a good thing. Nobody would recommend it. Nobody would say they had done the right thing. But you might excuse them. I think there's a terrible problem in ethics when you say, this would be wrong, but I could imagine a circumstance in which I'd excuse you. But I think there are times where people are under enormous pressure and under enormous strain, and they do things that are wrong. And we say, yes, that's wrong, we excuse you. But that also then presents a problem for our argument, because that seems like a get-out-of-jail-free card. I think what I would again point to is the argument that we've made all along, which is that everything is passable in our world, and there are some things that define us as a nation, and I believe that the prohibition on torture is one of them. And we can give ourselves up in more ways than just physical destruction. And that's a hard thing to hold to in the moment of disaster, but I believe that's where we do need to take our stand.